don't always agree with you, but I like listening to you, or I get a gain a new perspective. And where we can find compromise or find conversation with people that we don't necessarily agree with. And there was this Raskin, there's a New York Times article on Mr. Raskin from the Democrat from Maryland, and he is very left. And he's spent a lot of time recently studying white nationalism and authoritarian governments. And one of the things that he found is that one of the few places that one of the countries that were able to beat down authoritarian governments, the way that they were able to do it is liberals and progressives coming together to with people who are center right. How does that approach? Do you think one? I guess do you think it's possible? Mm-hmm. Do you think it's necessary? And do you think you could do it?
Yeah, I think. I mean, you're forced to work across the aisle. You're forced to connect with people that don't have your lived experience or your outlook in order to be effective in anything, right? I think it's the first trait that we're taught as kindergartners in school is how to talk to people about what interests them and vice versa. I think I struggled a lot with his idea that liberal progressive parties can work with center-right in terms of this particular time in American history and democracy when race is being used as a tool to divide us. I think on paper, obviously, if you want to get anywhere, you have to work and build coalitions. It's why I like Mandela so much. But I think when there is a refusal to acknowledge a certain humanity when it comes to Black lives, especially when it comes to racial equity, if the center right and the center left fundamentally disagree on the value and the worth of a human life, then how much coalition building are you actually doing? And so it's easy for me to be like, yeah, this is something that we should be doing, and this is idealistic solution to all our problems. But I also know that if we don't disagree on really important issues and we don't come to terms with the fact that some people are thinking the wrong way, then we're not going to move forward. And I think it comes about in different ways at different times. I think when you're having a conversation with a voter, you know, I've door knocked all over Wisconsin, I've door knocked in Lodi with people that, you know, didn't look like me in, you know, counties up north where I was legitimately like terrified of the way I was perceived as a Muslim woman door knocking by myself. But the conversations I had with Republicans humbled me in that I think the first woman I door knocked ever in my life, she had a Republican sign on her door. She opened the door and she was like, "Hey, it's hot outside. I know you're fasting. It's Ramadan. Do you want to come in?" And like, I had been in this state of mind as a Madisonian that this, even though it's 30 minutes away from Madison, that's this rural area, I wasn't going to be welcomed. I fell for the exact same thing that I had assumed of her, right? I was making judgments on her character while also being afraid that she was doing that for me. And so that was one of like the most formative experiences and one that I draw on often. And I think it informs why I fight so hard that Democrats do acknowledge race, because white fragility is a thing. And I believe in so much of the white people that I have met in terms of their ability to recognize my humanity, because I've had those conversations and they didn't end negatively, right? Maybe I didn't convince them in terms of a lot of the policy, but they did see me as a human being. And because I came to the door and brought my lived experience to them, hopefully in the future, that comes about in their voting decisions or policy decisions or whatever. And so I think that not only do we really have to have a serious reckoning about race, not only do we have to have hope that, you know, people across the aisle will be receptive of that lived experience, I think we have to fight white fragility, because I think a lot of what I see is that white establishment Democrats have less faith and their white counterparts than I and Black organizers do in those same people. And so that is why these conversations need to be had.
That is a great story. How'd the rest of the conversation go once you went inside?
Oh, she was like, I'm not voting for Andrew Lloyd, but let's talk about the issues that brought you here. And it was so incredibly just humbling, and it was such a great conversation, and she was so sweet. And it turns out that her, I think, maybe stepdaughter was from a Muslim majority country, so she had that kind of experience. But it was like, as like a young organizer, I was like, damn, like as a Madisonian, I'm just as complicit sometimes as everyone else. And so it went really, really well. I mean, I've had terrible experiences also, but I gave a speech about Islamophobia and being a Muslim a progressive in a county where people called the radio station beforehand saying that they were going to bring guns to my presentation. But the conversation ended up being so great, and I got numbers of people that, you know, were Trump supporters that were truly there to have a convo. And so, you know, it's not always rosy, but I think the majority of the time, the conversations, both parties leave with a little something. Yeah.
Which is interesting because, you know, one of the things you said when we were talking about Gen Z and the access of two different stories in different cultures in different countries what something, I was covering myself with my hand, the access to that is powered by social media, right? Like we have access to a different person's experience just by swiping through our phone. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, it also feels like the bane of where conversation goes to die on a lot of these issues, and where the stereotype of the other side and assuming the worst of the people who you don't agree with can really get accelerated. And so when you think of what we said as far as the idea that as a united front against a potential looming authoritarian government, like if that were to happen, is it through conversation? Is it through compromise? Or like knowing that I know where you stand as far as unable to do compromise or coalition building with people who don't recognize your humanity. But if you can get them there, is that only through in-face conversations?
Yeah, I think in-face conversation and experience is the best way. And I think a variety of it. I think social media is where nuance goes to die unless you're looking for nuance. And then you really can find so many different kind of faces of one side of the argument. So it's like, how do you motivate people to have that buy-in where they maybe, you know, something grabs their attention on social media, a fight or whatever, and they go and make the effort to find out more about an issue. I don't think we're at that second part most of the time. Certainly, I think me on Twitter, other people on Twitter have also made the mistake of seeing a headline and being like, this is exactly how I feel about it without looking at different aspects. And so, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, right? I think there's good parts and bad parts, and maybe more bad parts also sometimes with social media and politics. But I think it's such an accessible medium. It's making democracy so much more accessible than what it used to be. And so that is helping Gen Z a lot as well. But, you know, it's complex.
Yeah. Well, because I recently heard, this is apparently the fact that I haven't heard it before is on me, because it apparently is something that gets shared as a sentiment and often, but I hadn't heard it before, and it kind of struck me. The right looks for converts, the left looks for traitors.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring true to you?
I think some of the left looks for traitors. Another part of the left tries to educate and falls short in a lot of ways. I think again, big umbrella party, there's going to be nuance, there's going to be other things, but we got to come together when it comes to social issues, when it comes to Black and trans lives, when it comes to, you know, these ideals and values. There cannot be negotiation there because it is the humanity of certain people. And so I think that calling people a traitor trait on the left might be a natural response to frustration that certain humanities are not being appreciated or accepted as much as they are. Because I think I see that, at least on my world, it stems from a lot of those social policies. But when it comes to economic policy, you know, there's less of that shaming and more nuance. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, because I just... There's a Neil Brennan joke, the comedian Neil Brennan, who
he's great,
right? And he originally was Dave Chappelle's director. He was the co-creator of the Chappelle Show, white guy. And he has, I think it's in his Three Mics special, where it's not, I don't even know what the joke is, but the setup is basically how you're like, on the left, you're never left enough, and that there's a feedback loop as far as having to watch what you say, because someone, especially on social media, might come for you for not wording it in a correct way. And like, how often does this side of the aisle just turn potential, again, someone who could be a convert off because they feel like they're going to get yelled at or stepped on, like they're going to step in it and say it the wrong way. And then there's just certain people who maybe could be an ally or be, to use the word, convert, who throw up their hands and say, well, this doesn't feel good.
Yeah.
And so who is that on? Is it on that person, or is it on the movement to try to convince people to not make them feel alienated for using like the wrong terms or the wrong, not being all in on every policy and still not being there yet?
Yeah. I think that's the debate of cancel culture. And I think it is on both sides of the aisle. But I think for me, I personally would much rather go through the embarrassment of being wrong than knowing that I'm going to cause someone pain in the future if I'm not educated in terms of what term to use, whatever. Obviously, I will make mistakes. People all over are going to make mistakes. It's a learning process. It's an idea in a lot of these social, you know, phenomenons that goes against the status quo. And so there is a learning curve. I think for the most part, the rules of regular human interaction apply. I think most people find a way to move forward when someone does say something wrong. I've seen a lot of really great redirections, right? Not call outs, but redirections. I think it becomes a problem when people who are resistant to change for personal reasons decide that, you know, victimizing themselves is their way of refusing to move forward. So I think what you see on the right with Scott Walker's stupid org is this idea that the left is out to get everyone. The left is out to shame people. Not really. The left is setting a standard of how we treat each other with respect. And the people that are really upset about it aren't upset about the words that they need to be using per se. They're upset that their power, because it depends on stepping on other people, is being taken to task. And so I think this general debate of cancel culture, and I've talked to many an older white man who have kind of...
There's a lot of those, you know, in the Capitol.
No, there's so many. Some of them really great people and good friends, but my God. And like, they understand.
Overrepresented.
They're wonderful. I love them. I think they understand how deeply complex it is to try to convince people to see the way you see it. They're politicians who have been through it all, who have met so many different people. And so there is a little bit of validity to how they, you know, want us to be more careful about calling this stuff out. But also at the same time, you just got to tell someone when they're effing up, if they're effing out, especially when it comes to like the humanity of other people, because it's not every day about everything.
Yes, right? Absolutely. All right. Well, we only have one segment left before we're going to wrap up the show. So we're going to talk about paper. Super, super, you know, Wisconsin, the paper state. So let's talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
This is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.